Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Clients discover commercial real estate opportunities around the world and across industries. JLL.com. JLL. See a brighter way.
Okay, quick. What's a four-letter word that can tell us where this economy is going? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey, protecting the applications and accounts that people and businesses rely on every day. YubiKey helps stop phishing attempts and hackers. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com. And by UKG, their HR, pay, and workforce management tools are designed to help business leaders build trust and empower their people. UKG, because when work works, everything works. More at ukg.com/work. And by JumpCloud, simplifying IT through its intelligent, unified, AI-backed platform that securely connects users to any resource from any device anywhere. JumpCloud, helping organizations prepare for AI acceleration.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, December the 4th. Good as it always is to have you along, everybody. The theme of the program today, the first 8 or so minutes, is time. T-I-M-E. What is it, really? We begin with the lagging indicators. Think about it. That have been coming to us as federal data plays catch up from the shutdown. The delayed September jobs report, a tardy retail sales release, and then tomorrow, the September personal consumption expenditures index, of intense interest to Fed Chair Jay Powell and the gang ahead of their last interest rate setting meeting of the year next Tuesday and Wednesday.
You know, we're going into year end and we're going into the holiday season. So data from September, I don't know about you, but September feels quite a long time ago.
Yeah, sure does. Andrea Eisfeldt, a professor of finance at UCLA Anderson.
That said, some economic trends do tend to be more slow moving. So I think we have seen from several data sources that in particular for smaller businesses, there have been fewer jobs created and we probably see a bit of a softening in the labor market there.
Remember, we talked about small businesses yesterday and their job losses. Labor market softness, of course, is something the Fed is watching, as we've been talking about. But the big shadow over all of this is what we don't know. And by that, I mean the releases we are never going to see, and particularly the unemployment report for October. Nina Eihacker's at the University of Rhode Island.
If anyone wants to make a case for a cut, having access to that jobs data is extra important in all of this.
Go on.
The Fed can maybe make more reasonable estimates about the effects of tariffs and whatever on the costs of production, which they're certainly doing. I mean, I think that that's a big part of the uncertainty with the Fed right now. But those job numbers are really, really important for that other mandate that the Fed has.
Two things the Fed is required to do, right? The dual mandate, stable prices and maximum employment. Jay Powell's press conference Wednesday next. You'll be hearing a lot about both of those things. Do not miss it. You know, sometimes to go forward in time, to understand what is going to happen, which we're going to do with Mitchell Hartman in a minute, you got to go back in time. Our point of entry is a report in the Financial Times this week that bond investors, which, remember, the bond market can tell us where the economy is going. Those investors have been letting the White House know, shall we say, that they are concerned about who President Trump might pick to replace Jay Powell and how independent or not that person's going to be. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes things from there.
The easiest way to understand why it is so important for the Fed to be independent is to look at a time when it was not, more than 40 years ago.
History provides a warning here.
David Krause is Emeritus Professor of Finance at Marquette University.
Arthur Burns and William Miller succumbed to pressures of Nixon, Ford, and Carter to keep interest rates low, which continued to allow inflation to run unchecked.
Inflation reached more than 13% in 1979. Eventually, a new Fed chair, Paul Volcker, had to clean up the mess by severely raising interest rates, and it was grisly.
I lived through this. We went through a double-dip recession in the early 1980s because we just had to wring inflation expectations out of the economy.
It's the inflation part of all this that scares the bond market.
Inflation is really the enemy of bonds.
Colin Martin is head of fixed income research at the Schwab Center for Financial Research. When you own a bond, you are kind of stuck with whatever interest rate it pays out. And if all of a sudden everything in your life is more expensive because of inflation,
it makes that bond investment just less attractive in a high inflationary environment.
Investors do not like losing money, so if they do start getting a whiff that inflation might ramp up again later, they'll just refuse to buy long-term bonds that do not give them a little something extra to make up for it. So then long-term bonds have to start offering that little something extra. And then all kinds of investments start doing the same, which makes borrowing in general more expensive.
There is really no place you can hide in that environment.
Fahad Malik is a portfolio manager at AllianceBernstein.
Treasury yields are rising, equities are most likely selling off, and credit is most likely selling off as well. That's not necessarily good for capital markets.
All that said, the name of the person who becomes the next Fed chair isn't as important as what they do. Marvin Lowe is global macro strategist at State Street.
All of the candidates that are being floated do have credentials that would make them efficient leaders for the Federal Reserve. It really depends how they approach it.
And whether history starts to rhyme. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking of history rhyming, you remember I said the other day traders are just marking time? There's that word again. Waiting on the Fed meeting. Yeah, I'm sticking with that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So, again, time. What is it, really? We know with a reasonable degree of certainty what the central bank's meeting next week is going to bring. A quarter percentage point cut in the Federal Reserve's main interest rate, the federal funds rate, it's called. A perhaps better and maybe more important question is what the Fed's December meeting next year is going to be like. If, as, again, we can say with a reasonable degree of certainty, a very low interest rate friendly person becomes the next chair. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is the ghost of the federal funds rate yet to come.
Good day to you, Kai. Well, as you know, the summer of 2026 was blazing hot. Then we had that freak Thanksgiving Day blizzard. And just like this time last year, the Fed's Open Market Committee will gather next week to set interest rates in its final 2026 meeting. By which point, economists I have just polled agree the federal funds rate will be lower than it was 1 year ago.
Approximately 2.75%.
3%.
3.25.
Okay, now I'm back in December 2025. And yeah, the economists I interviewed predict a range of federal funds rates 1 year from now. Jay Hatfield at Infrastructure Capital Advisors came in with the lowest estimate, below 3%, which would certainly stimulate the economy.
Our models show that inflation is contained and likely to decline, particularly as shelter inflation gradually drops down to market rates. And 2.75 is the historical 30-year average of Fed funds.
Economist Joe Bruswellis at RSM predicts a 3% Fed funds rate, a bit below where the Fed itself predicts the rate will be. He thinks rates could end up higher, though.
There's risk to the upside around growth and inflation, which may require the Fed to make a quick U-turn and hike rates, which would clearly exacerbate tensions with the White House, regardless of who's in charge of the Federal Reserve.
We know the White House would like to see rates much lower, maybe as low as 2%. Kevin Hassett, as the new chair, could try to steer the Fed in that direction, but Daniela Hathorn at Capital.com says it wouldn't be a slam dunk.
Kevin Hassett is expected to be more pro-growth, but of course he can't completely ignore inflation.
And there are other unknowns that make prediction really hard, says former Fed economist Claudia Sahm.
big changes that could happen at the Fed in terms of a Supreme Court allowing the president to remove a governor. I think at the end of the day, the economy is going to drive where rates go, but it could be a pretty uncomfortable ride.
And she says one thing that financial markets do not like is economic uncertainty, or, you know, being haunted by ghosts. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
How you're experiencing inflation depends a whole lot on what you're spending money on. And for a lot of families, the high and rising cost of childcare has been especially tough to handle. Between 2020 and 2024, and this is from the organization Child Care Aware of America, the average cost of childcare in this economy rose nearly 30%. That data point brings us to the next story in our series, Lived Economies. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has been following people from across the country as they negotiate the changes in this economy, which for us today means two families that have been trying to figure out whether it makes sense for one of the parents to keep working or to stay home with the kids. Here's Kristen.
Life at Julie Yang and Daniel Tao's house in St. Paul Park, Minnesota is a little chaotic these days. But then again, life is always busy when you have six kids.
I'm sorry. I have Austin and Tatum right here with me.
Julie says the family has been going through some kid drama. Asher, who's in the third grade, has become a bit of a class clown.
We just had conferences and I heard really bad reviews, so I was pretty upset with that. So now he's grounded.
Meanwhile, Isla, who's five, had a falling out with a friend.
Something had happened at school and she was like, yeah, well, she yelled at me and told me she wasn't my friend anymore. And then she told all the other girls not to like me.
Typical kid stuff, really. What's not so typical is what's happening with their newborn. Sachi was born preterm with a congenital heart defect and had to have a major surgery. Julie says he requires a lot of care.
We just left a three-hour genetic appointment yesterday. I feel like I've been at the doctor's every week.
Julie recently made the difficult decision to cut way back on her hours at her job as a nurse. It means the family lost their state child care assistance and Julie's part-time nursing pay, about $30,000. So the two have been dipping into their savings. They've told the kids to expect one gift each this Christmas.
One special gift.
Though Julie's family is dealing with some particularly big challenges, raising kids in the U.S. has always required families to improvise, especially when it comes to juggling schedules and finances. Taryn Morrissey is a professor of public administration and policy at American University.
And to have young children in general is somewhat of a leap of faith and an economically scary prospect, right?
But Morrissey says the rising cost of healthcare, daycare, and groceries is coming to a head.
It's an intense, economically uncertain moment, and families are facing a lot of pressures.
Those pressures may be pushing some parents to restructure their lives. The number of households paying for childcare, it's down more than 1.5% from a year ago, according to recent data from Bank of America. Meanwhile, the number of households receiving multiple paychecks is also down. The trend is most common among lower income families.
People are making these complicated calculations. So it's just that many families don't seem to have real options.
Still, even families that do seem to have options are making tough decisions. Hannah and Tamari and Kareem Adassi in Sacramento had their second daughter, Summer, earlier this year.
Honestly, she's our dream child. She's a great sleeper. She's such a happy baby. She's always smiling. She's your by-the-book baby.
Hannah considered leaving her job in real estate to become a full-time mom, but the budget wasn't budgeting. $50 boxes of diapers, the $8,000 hospital bill from Summer's birth, paying for all that without Hannah's $85,000 salary, while also trying to save up to buy their first home, felt impossible.
It was a hard decision, you know. There are days where I do want to stay at home, you know, and I wish that the financial reality of living in California was a lot easier for a family just living on one income to have that full security.
Plus, Hannan likes working. She wants to set that example for her daughters. And she's heard people in her mom groups talk about how hard it is to get back to work after time off.
I go back and forth. I do have mom guilt about, you know, wanting to be at home, be present, not miss anything.
It's a decision that so many parents are familiar with. Stay home with the kids, go back to work. One way or another, you feel like you're missing out. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, why haven't you guys, done anything yet?
Tough, but fair. Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 31 points today, about a 10%, 47,850. The NASDAQ rose 51 points, about 0.2%, 23,505. The S&P 500 notched 7 points to the good, a 10%, 68,57. Grocery chain Kroger reported third quarter earnings today and said it now expects slower sales growth for the full year. The interim CEO said today that high-income families are still spending. Middle-income families are beginning to feel more pressure, he said. Kroger slid 4.6%. Walmart up 0.4%. Costco down 2.9% on the day. Consumer Reports just published its annual list of top car manufacturers based on reliability, safety, and owner satisfaction. Top of the list this year, Subaru. BMW is a close second. Here's the interesting part. Tesla moved from 18 last year to 10 this year. Go figure that out. You're listening to Marketplace.
The numbers is supported by Odoo.com, your entire business on one platform. Marketplace is supported by Solidigm. Today's AI ambitions require a different approach to storage. Solidigm offers solid-state storage solutions optimized for AI with higher capacities, greater speed, and energy efficiency. Storage for AI.com. And by Ninja One, helping organizations manage, protect, and support every device and every user, all from one platform that automates IT and strengthens security. More at ninjaone.com. And by the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to raising awareness and accelerating action on America's fiscal challenges to build a brighter economic future for the next generation. Learn more at pgpf.org.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Ballet, presenting the holiday tradition Nutcracker. Listeners can experience the captivating music, magical performances, and an onstage blizzard. Runs December 5th to 28th. Tickets at sfballet.org. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, announcing the Season of New Traditions event, going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com. 18 minutes past 4 o'clock. My name is Michelle Hennigan. Julie Deppish will be here with your traffic update after Marketplace. All Things Considered starts at 4:30.
We hear the word ideology a lot these days from both conservatives and liberals. How the meaning of the word has changed on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4:30 here on member-supported KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are now less than a month out from subsidies for the Affordable Care Act going away. As you know, one of the defining disagreements between Democrats and Republicans before, during, and after the government shutdown. It's anybody's guess what Washington's going to do, but there is, in the meanwhile, a slice of the U.S. healthcare economy that is expanding with bipartisan support, no less. Patrick Cooley wrote in the Washington Post the other day about low-cost health plans for farmers that are now being offered through farm bureaus in 12 states. It should be said that these plans are not ACA compliant, which means, among other things, they don't have to cover people with pre-existing conditions. Patrick, welcome to the program. It's good to have you on.
Thank you.
Would you first of all tell us, just so we all know, what these state farm bureaus are, what they do?
The simplest answer would be advocacy organizations. They also provide certain services, like, for example, they set farmers up with crop insurance. Mm-hmm. They do things like lobby state lawmakers. And from my end, they occasionally work with journalists providing commentary and things like that.
And working on stories like this one. So let's take it to the next step in the subject of this piece. They also offer healthcare insurance. And I need you to help me understand the challenge that farmers have with healthcare coverage.
Yeah, so it's a couple of different issues. One, their income is not the same from year to year. You know, the price of corn, the price of milk, the price of beef, it's not always the same. So, you know, they can't go into the year saying this is how much I'm going to make. So in that respect, it's difficult for them to get insurance on these marketplaces because they don't know what their income's going to be from the year. They also, most of them also don't qualify for subsidies. A lot of them end up buying insurance on the AC exchanges anyway, but it's incredibly expensive. One of the farmers I talked to said that her father gets healthcare through the Affordable Care Act exchanges, but he pays something like $2,400 a month.
Right,
so,
those subsidies have for sure been in the news. And as we have talked to many a farmer on this program, they are price takers, not price makers. What generally do farmers and we should be clear here, this is a relatively small number of people, but the farm economy is huge. Just net. So what do they think of this coverage that they're able to get from coverage from their state farm bureaus?
Well, it runs the gamut. The farmers who are able to get coverage that I talked to, they like it, but a lot of them don't qualify and their employees don't qualify because they might have pre-existing conditions. So they're a little reticent. The farmers that don't qualify, for them, it's like, why even bother offering this if I can't qualify? But the ones who are able to get it, they seem to really like it. You know, they don't have to pay too much for it. It covers most of what health insurance would cover, you know, medical procedures, doctor's appointments, things like that.
Yeah. You point out in this piece, we should say, that these plans from these state farm bureaus are not unlike what the Trump administration has proposed, right? Cheap, short-term plans as an Affordable Care Act sort of alternative. Makes sense of that for me.
Yeah, so the way they're pitched is as an affordable option for farmers. The caveat, though, is that it is not regulated the same way as the insurance you might get through your employer or the insurance you get on the marketplace is regulated. It in a lot of ways goes back to insurance, the way insurance was before the Affordable Care Act, in that if you have pre-existing conditions, they can deny you. They're also not required to continue insuring you if you develop some sort of chronic condition. Now, I want to be clear, the farm bureaus I talked to at least said that they will not do that. But since this doesn't follow the same rules as most other insurance, there's nothing stopping them. And I should clarify, in most of these states, they're not allowed to call it insurance for that very reason, because it doesn't follow those regulations.
Those seem to be pretty significant caveats, just saying.
Yes. I actually talked to a farmer who said that they probably wouldn't consider this because they have several employees who have ongoing medical conditions, and they wouldn't want to offer a plan that couldn't get those employees. So, yeah, it's a pretty big caveat.
For sure. Patrick Cooley writes for an outfit and works for an outfit called Industry Dive. He wrote this piece for The Washington Post. Patrick, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me on.
Here's today's entry in the, we got data for everything file. The global market for the restoration of historic buildings sits at more than $120 billion. So says Archive Market Research. And we do, of course, have plenty of historic buildings out there just waiting for the right person to come along and give them a second life. So here with today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Dana Winook. I am the executive director for the Livingston Arts Council. And today we are at the Howell Opera House. It's seen a lot in its time. Opera houses were more of like a community gathering place. So every graduation from the high school was here. Court was here. Performances. Ironically, only like one or two operas, according to our historians. It was built in 1881 and closed in 1924 for fear of it burning down. You know, this is all lath and plaster and clearly just wood. So, you know, it was common for opera houses to just burn down. So for us, they said, nope. Fire Marshal shut it down and it sat here since. I've been working in nonprofits for over 15 years, and when I saw this position open up, I came into the interview and they walked me in and showed me the space, and I was like, this is so cool. Like, you can almost hear the space, you know, wanting to be active. And I'm like, well, why haven't you guys, you know, done anything yet? And they had said, well, we're volunteers. We've been working on this for 20 years, but at a volunteer's pace, we just really need someone to come in and do this every day. And I'm like, I can totally do this. We've got about $2 million from the state in a grant, and then another $500,000 promised from a couple different private donors. So that $2.5 million will go do a few things that you can see here. We'll level up the floor. We'll redo most of the plaster. We are actually planning to launch our first opera in May. We're going to do Pirates of Penzance. That's the kind of production that would have been done here. The production will be a little bit toned down because there's no technology on this stage. Even all the light bulbs that you see are knob and tube that have been cut because it's a fire hazard. And you can even see, like, if we go look, you can see the old limelight, like the old gas lights, which makes sense why this place was burning down. I mean, why these places were burning down, because you literally got open flame just standing here on the stage. You know, and then here we come in May. I don't know, is it going to be 100 degrees? Is it going to be 32 degrees? And you can feel it is. There's no heat. There's no cooling. There's nothing in here. And then we can put 500 people in here, but they all have to climb stairs. You want it to be a community center. You want everyone to be involved. Everyone should have access to it. So we've got to find an elevator. An elevator is about $1 million. Everyone who comes up here, they always say, oh, it'd be so cool to just see this place up and running again. You know, and the work that goes into that, all of these stamps have to be traced and recreated, right? Because there's also, you know, there's a difference between build new and preservation. I don't think the work will ever be done, to be honest with you. I really don't. Like, it's a historic building. Every time you find something and you think it's just at rest, something else happens. So, you know, just kind of getting it to a spot where it can maintain itself and bring in really cool things for the community and the surrounding neighbors. That's my goal.
Come on, tell me again history's not amazing. Dana Minooks, the executive director of the Livingston Arts Council in Howell, Michigan. Whether you are revamping something old or making something totally new, tell us about it. Marketplace.org/myeconomy.
Marketplace is supported by Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering a small ship experience with a shore excursion included in every port and onboard cultural enrichment. Discover more at Viking.com. And by Progressive Insurance, providing direct car insurance rates side by side with other insurance carriers. Customers can see rates and find an option that works for their needs. Now, that's Progressive. Learn more at Progressive.com.
This final note on the way out today, in which I regret to inform you that not only is the gender pay gap still alive and well, it is getting worse. This is data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics out today. In the third quarter of this year, on a full-time basis, women made just shy of 81% of what men made. The record narrowness of that gap, by the way, almost 85% women to men in early 2023. Our daily production team includes Libby Burdett, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. Will Story is the supervising senior producer. And I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All Things Considered is just ahead here on KQED. A report on what's happening at the Pentagon is first on today's program. After the newscast and after KQED traffic starting in San Jose, here's Julie Depesh.
Well, Cara, in an SUV, got into it on North 880 at the Alameda. That's the left lane block to heavy backup to Stevens Creek. Heads up in Hayward on the southbound 880 off-ramp to Industrial Parkway. A stall there is blocking the left lane of the off-ramp. And road work continues until tonight at Martinez. Highway 4 westbound at Pine Street. Alternating lanes are closed, so that's causing a backup to Morello. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Genentech, the original biotech pioneer, forging life-altering scientific breakthroughs to help improve the lives of all patients. Learn more about Genentech's commitment to patients and society at gene.com/ourpromise. And from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meet a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters. Please drink responsibly. It's 4:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Legendary guitarist and songwriter Steve Cropper has died. He was best known for his role in the backing band Booker T and the MGs.
I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records. But really, I'm a rhythm man.
First the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump welcomed world leaders from Africa to the White House today, praising the leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda for their courage to sign a peace deal. Central Africa has been battered by decades of conflict with more than 100 armed groups. Today's peace accord is aimed at ending fighting between the two countries. That agreement will also open up access to the Congo's critical minerals for the U.S., which are used in a wide range of products from smartphones and computers to advanced military equipment.
Today, the United States is also signing our own bilateral agreements with the Congo and Rwanda that will unlock new opportunities for the United States to access critical minerals and provide economic benefits for everybody.
But not everyone is happy. Congolese residents have expressed skepticism about the peace deal as fighting continues in eastern Congo. The leader of a Palestinian militia that opposes Hamas has been killed. He was backed and armed by Israel in southern Gaza. NPR's Aya Batraoui has more.
Yasser Abu-Shabaab is known locally as a notorious criminal who was in prison for drug smuggling when the war in Gaza began. Later, he became known as the leader of the Abu-Shabaab militia, named after him. Palestinian aid workers say his militia was behind deadly attacks on aid trucks and the single biggest theft of UN aid globally, when around 100 trucks were looted late last year. The lootings plunged Gaza into starvation as UN bakeries ran out of flour. Hamas militants tried to kill Yasser Abu-Shabaab, but he fled with his militia to southern Gaza under the protection of Israeli forces, where he was being tapped to lead an armed resistance against Hamas. Palestinian reports say he was killed Thursday in a dispute with a local family. NPR couldn't reach Abu Shabab's deputy for comment, but an Israeli defense official told NPR Israel believes he's been killed. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Pamela Price is running again for district attorney in Alameda County just a year after she was recalled from the position. The civil rights prosecutor was overwhelmingly ousted last November amid complaints of high crime and allegations of incompetence and misconduct in her office. Speaking today, Price said she was forced out by a small group of wealthy elites who opposed her progressive policies.
Alameda County wants real justice that does not bend for wealth, status, or political connections. I will be the district attorney who puts people first.
During her tenure, Price launched a division to investigate police misconduct and filed resentencing motions in dozens of death row cases after evidence of prosecutorial bias surfaced. This morning's false earthquake warning was likely triggered by what USGS officials are describing as a ground movement out in the field. KQED senior science editor Kevin Stark reports they say it wasn't an earthquake, but they're not yet sure what caused the shaking.
The U.S. Geological Survey says four seismic stations in Nevada detected the ground movement, and that's what triggered the alert that went off on phones across the Bay Area. In the past, the early warning system has alerted more people than necessary. military. Operations lead Robert DeGroup says that wasn't the case this time.
But this is the very first time where we've had sort of what I call a through-and-through false alert delivery because of something that may have happened out somewhere out in the field.
The USGS is analyzing data from its stations and considering launching a field investigation. I'm Kevin Stark, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Postman, used by 40 million developers to build APIs that help AI make smarter decisions. More at postman.com. Support for KQED comes from Post Peninsula Open Space Trust. Post has protected and cared for more than 93,000 acres of open space on the peninsula and in the South Bay for the benefit of all. Learn more at openspacetrust.org. And from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, raising funds as a response to recent public policy changes to support local nonprofits that provide access to food, health care, and shelter to those in need. Learn more at svcf.org. Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical, starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, in movie theaters starting December 5th. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com. And from the listeners of member-supported KQED 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI 89.3 North Highland, Sacramento.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Did Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth put American lives at risk? A new report from the Pentagon says he did when he shared sensitive operational details in a signal chat earlier this year. That chat was about a U.S. bombing mission in Yemen, and it inadvertently included a journalist, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic magazine. I talked this through today on our National Security Podcast, Sources and Methods, with Tom Bowman, who covers the Pentagon, and Quill Lawrence, who covers veterans. Okay, Tom, the report, where's it coming from? Who wrote it? What's it say? Headlines.
This is a Pentagon Inspector General, and this report was called for by the two leaders on the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Roger Wicker and also Senator Jack Reed. They asked for it shortly after news reports about the signal chats done by Hegseth a couple of hours before these strikes in Yemen. So they were disturbed by the reports, and they called for the IG to look into this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sent to the Pentagon a couple of months ago for their review, and it just was released today.
And to what is surely the most explosive line that people are focused on, the conclusion that Hegseth could have put U.S. troops at risk. How so? What's it say?
Well, it basically says, and Quill has more information on this, that through the signal risk, potential compromise to sensitive DOD information, quote, which could cause harm to DOD personnel and mission objectives. Basically, someone could tap into that information on signal and, you know, relay it to adversaries or, you know, and it put in danger the pilots who are flying in.
Signal, again, just to remind people, an excellent app. I use it to communicate regularly, but it is not a government app. It is not a classified app. Military officials are not supposed to be discussing battle plans on it.
And we aren't supposed to discuss it without mentioning that NPR CEO Catherine Mayer is on the board of the Signal Foundation.
Chairs the board of the Signal Foundation, indeed.
Yeah, I've got the report in my hand here in the studio. It's 76 pages, and you can, it doesn't do anything to contradict what was published, indeed leaked to The Atlantic magazine in real time, which is basically that...
Just to be clear, it wasn't even leaked. They asked
correct.
The editor-in-chief of The Atlantic to join this group chat, not knowing that
he was
improperly
added to this signal
exactly.
chat. And he listened in and got all this information.
Yep.
And so, I mean, what it basically says is that emails, classified emails marked classified, were coming from the CENTCOM commander about these impending military operations against the Houthi rebels in Yemen. And that Hegseth also pretty much in real time sent them out several hours before these operations took place, 2 to 4 hours, and he sent them over signal, which would have been a terrible breach because you can't send classified information out to people who aren't authorized to see it, including this journalist. But it does say that because he was the classifying authority of this information, he could declassify it at any time. And so apparently by sending this out, he was then deciding that he was declassifying
it. This has been a central point of contention that lawmakers, reporters, others have been trying to figure out, was classified information inadvertently revealed? And the argument it sounds like Hegseth has made is, it was classified, but I'm the SecDef and I can declassify it, and that's what I did.
But right. There's a process to doing that. You can't just say, in my mind, I'm going to declassify it. There's a process, a written process you have to go through. And let's also look at exactly what he was sending. Target information, the timing of aircraft, the F-18 aircrafts going to attack Houthi rebels.
And drones and Tomahawk missiles.
Correct. But the most important thing, of course, is if I'm flying an F-18 into Yemen and this guy is sending information over unsecured channels, that could put me at risk. If an adversary gets that information and knows I'm coming, that's the key here.
Right. And this report talks a lot about classified information, whether he could declassify, etc. But it takes till page 25, and I want to read this.
Mm-hmm.
To finally lay it out, and it says, the secretary sent information identifying the quantity and strike times of manned U.S. aircraft, so people aboard, not a drone that you shoot down, over hostile territory, over an unapproved, unsecure network, approximately 2 to 4 hours before the execution of those strikes. Although the secretary wrote in his 25 July statements that there were, quote, no details that would endanger our troops or the mission, if this information had fallen into the hands of U.S. adversaries, Houthi forces might have been able to counter U.S. forces, i.e. shoot them down, shoot at them, or reposition personnel and assets to avoid planned U.S. strikes. Even though these events did not ultimately occur, the secretary's actions created a risk to operational security that could have resulted in failed U.S. mission objectives and potential harm to U.S.
pilots. And it's important to note that at the time when the news came out, exactly what happened with Signal and Hegseth's role, that he said there was no classified information that was sent out. But this report clearly says, no, it was secret information, not for foreign distribution either.
Right.
So it was quite clear about that. And I got to tell you one thing. After this broke, the story broke, I got calls from like 3 or 4 military people who were astounded and angry about this. And they said, Tom, if I had done this, I would at least lose my security clearance, maybe go to jail.
Let me back us up just to how the Inspector General looked into this, how the Inspector General office knows what they know. Did Secretary Hegseth cooperate with all this? Did he sit down and do an interview?
He gave a brief statement. He would not sit down for an interview. And he didn't release all of the messages that were over Signal. They had to get them through the Atlantic.
Right.
That's what happened.
The editor, Jeff Goldberg, had screenshotted it and then
Correct.
Published it.
And also they said, by the way, that Hegseth said he thinks the IG is partisan, the report was biased. That's his view of this report.
And just to add a couple more tidbits, he refused to be interviewed.
You're deep in this report. Keep going, Quill.
Sorry. It's just, I did speed read it before we sat down here. It just came out a couple of hours ago at the time of this taping. But, yeah, the SecDef refused to be interviewed. And he repeatedly said there was no classified evidence, which is okay if he didn't classify it, and no war plans. But it's very clear that they describe here what are really war plans, or at least attack plans, depending on whether you say we're at war with the Houthis or not.
Yeah.
Signal chats delete automatically, which essentially this report says in so many ways was the destruction of evidence. They could not get that evidence because the signal is set to delete automatically, which is why it's against DOD policy to use it. It's like having a virtual shredder on your device. It disappears the information. And the last bit is that, you know, we had heard reports of other group chats, not just the one with, say, the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President, people, okay, you could send this information to. You don't mean to be sending it to the Atlantic. But this report looked into and heard from 5 officials who said that Hegseth was messaging in other group chats. But essentially, because he refused to turn over his personal phone to the IG, he refused to cooperate fully with this investigation, they couldn't confirm reports that he was sending out these same attack details to people like his wife or his brother.
I will inject. The White House is defending Hegseth. They put out a statement and it reads, quote, this review affirms what this administration has said from the beginning. No classified information was leaked and operational security was not compromised. And it goes on to say President Trump stands by Secretary Hegseth.
That was an excerpt from NPR's National Security Podcast, Sources and Methods. You heard me talking with NPR's Quill Lawrence and Tom Bowman. You can hear the whole episode wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We hear the term ideology a lot these days.
I will take historic action to defeat the toxic poison of gender ideology and reaffirm that God created two genders, male and female.
Promotions and admissions are based on merit and not on other ideologies.
Christian nationalism is an ideology that this was founded as a Christian nation.
There clearly was a leftist ideology with this assassin.
The voices you heard there, President Trump, Education Secretary Linda McMahon, scholar Brad Onishi, and Utah Governor Spencer Cox. For our Word of the Week segment today, NPR religion and belief correspondent Jason DeRose takes on ideology.
The French Enlightenment philosopher Antoine de Tracy first coined the word ideology. He had a notion.
We use science to study all sorts of things, and we should also use science to study ideas as well.
Samuel Chan, who teaches political thought at Occidental College, says de Tracy meant the term to be neutral, but ideology was quickly taken up by Napoleon to describe the beliefs of his enemies.
Who were not only arguing for a study of ideas, but who were also arguing for republicanism and liberalism that was at odds with Napoleon's own political ambitions.
Not long after Napoleon, Karl Marx began using the term, says Chan, to describe a false class consciousness.
If you are a worker and yet you are not up there for a strike or revolution, and yet you are serving the interests of the capitalist class, and somehow you believe that's good for you, that's because you are beholden to the ideology of the ruling class.
Ideology has essentially become a form of name-calling. It's a way of sort of saying you have ridiculous or stupid beliefs.
That's Jason Blakely, who teaches politics at Pepperdine University. He's also the author of the book Lost in Ideology. Both conservatives and liberals use the term, he says, when someone on the right uses it, as in, say, gender ideology.
What they often mean is a faddish set of beliefs that will sort of destroy the moral and traditional order that's there from time out of mind and possibly lead to the decline and fall of civilization.
Blakely hears a different meaning from the left with, say, the phrase Christian nationalist ideology.
They often mean hierarchies that are unjustified, that are thoughtlessly sort of inherited and traditional, and that is sort of hem in emancipation and human flourishing and fulfillment.
Rather than using the word ideology to describe a set of beliefs, Samuel Chan prefers the term worldview or narrative.
The story of how people not only give meaning to their lives, but also give meaning to the community that they've been in or the history of the community.
Which, he argues, allows for greater empathy toward another's beliefs. But Jason Blakely has this proposal for people who really want to change someone's mind.
I would like us to think of ideology more in the analogy of religion, where religious people think their religion is true, but they tend to also understand that it's a cultural tradition that you have to speak out of and persuade people into.
By demonstrating, says Blakely, the truth of one's own beliefs, rather than casting another's as wrong. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Your KQED traffic update at 4:48 starts with trouble on the Dublin Grade. Here's Julie Deppish.
Yeah, we do have a downed motorcycle there on eastbound 580 at Rao Ranch. It's blocking at least the left lane. Heavy backup now to Eden Canyon. Some better news, San Jose. They've cleared that wreck that was northbound 880 before the Alameda. Still unwinding, a little slow back to Bascom Avenue. And we have a crash in Napa on Highway 29. It's northbound after Jameson Canyon Road. You'll see a car and a pickup truck on the right shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie, we'll have another update 8 in 10 minutes. Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity. Imagine that. And from Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at aseasontosparkle.com.
This week on Bay Curious.
I'm Gabriella Glick. The Nimitz House is this grand-looking house tucked underneath the Bay Bridge's eastern span. I ended up talking to someone who lived there, and it turns out that the Nimitz House is kind of a vestige of Yerba Buena Island's military history. It was the house for the top commanding officer on base, and the house has fallen into a bit of disrepair.
Listen to the new episode now, wherever you get your podcasts.
On the next California Report magazine, rescued audio recordings from a queer church in San Francisco that provided a refuge during the height of the AIDS crisis.
Each one is of infinite worth, whether that person is diseased or not. We have AIDS as a community, and God loves us.
I'm Sasha Coca. Join us Friday afternoon on KQED or on the California Report Magazine podcast.
Tomorrow afternoon at 4:30.
Our news. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Elephant seals are huge, gray, and blubbery. They have a big snout and a very distinctive voice. But despite the obvious differences, elephant seals actually have something in common with humans. They don't forget their enemies. Researchers from the University of California, Santa Cruz, say male elephant seals remember their competition from previous breeding seasons. Carolyn Casey presented this research at a recent conference in Hawaii and joins us now. Hi there.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, Carolyn, I know you have been studying seals for more than a decade, so I just want to start off with a super basic question. What makes an elephant seal different from other seals?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, for me, elephant seals are one of the most amazing animals in the animal kingdom. But among seals, they are, you know, some of the deepest divers of any seals. They're one of the largest of all of the seal species. They're the most sexually dimorphic, meaning that males look different than females. And to me, they have one of the most interesting breeding systems.
Interesting. Okay, so how did you discover that elephant seals remember the calls of their rivals?
Yeah, this is a really long-term study that me and my colleagues have been evaluating for the past 13 years at Ane Nuevo State Park, located in California. So at that site, we track individual male seals once they arrive on the breeding beaches. You know, elephant seals go on these amazing foraging migrations, and they spend most of their life at sea. But each year, they come back to the same sites every year to breed, and the males arrive first, and they fight for access to breeding opportunities. So once they arrive, our colleagues and I start tracking them. And we have just discovered so many amazing things about them, including the fact that they have these unique voices. We've done lots of experiments that demonstrate that each male has a unique voice or name that they learn and remember during the breeding season to cut down on the costs associated with fighting, because they don't want to be fighting all the time, but they need to remember who one another is. And so to do that, they basically have names.
Can you talk a little bit about how you conducted this research and how you specifically worked with those unique sounds that elephant seals make?
Yeah, sure. So from our previous research, we knew that males will respond deferentially depending on the dominant status of the caller. So for example, if a male within a season hears his most dominant rival, he'll run away, even in the absence of the male being there themselves. And if he hears his most subordinate rival, he'll sometimes attack or go towards the speaker or the sound. And so we would track males during 1 year. We would record his most familiar dominant rivals, and then we would try to find him again the next year and play back the sounds of his familiar rivals. And what we wanted to know was, are these males responding the same way that they would have in the previous year, or is everything being reset, or they don't maybe recall those signals over time? So those were the types of questions that we were asking.
I want to ask, do you have a favorite, like, individual seal?
Yes. You played him at the beginning of your intro, and I'm so happy you did. It's X579.
X579, that's his name?
Yes, that's his name. And he has such a unique call. And he just was one of these males that came back every year. He started out as like this kind of subordinate, not very dominant male, worked his way up the dominance hierarchy, and then was a dominant male for 3 years, three consecutive seasons. So he's just this like incredible success story. So few males ever get to breed. You know, less than 5% of males born ever attain breeding status or become what we call alpha males. And so he's just, I loved him. He was great.
That's Carolyn Casey, research scientist at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Guitarist, songwriter, and producer Steve Cropper has died. The musician helped to define what became known as the Memphis Sound as a member of Booker T and the MGs, the house band at Stax record label. He also wrote and produced some of American pop music's most foundational songs. Cropper died in Nashville yesterday. He was 84, and Pure's Chloe Veltman has this remembrance.
Some of the world's best-known songs have Steve Cropper's stamp on them. He co-wrote this 1967 hit with Otis Redding.
I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
And in 1962, created this groovy instrumental track with Booker T and the MGs. Here Cropper is playing the guitar solo on Green Onions.
I think Steve and Booker had been working on a little riff for a while that went something like dum dum da dum dum.
Stax Records co-founder Jim Stewart spoke at Booker T and the MGs Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 1992 about the Sunday 30 years previously when Cropper and the rest of the band took that riff and ran with it.
We almost wore the tape out that night listening to it. The next day we had a demo on the air, and we were getting calls on the record immediately.
Steve Cropper's guitar style was clean and concise. He even gets a shout-out for his work on Sam and Dave's 1966 single, Soul Man. In 1996, the UK's Mojo magazine placed Cropper second on its list of the world's 100 greatest guitarists of all time, right behind Jimi Hendrix. According to the Memphis Music Hall of Fame, Hendrix counted Cropper as an influence. But as Cropper told Terry Gross in a 1990 interview on WHYY's Fresh Air, he did not see himself as a lead guitarist.
I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records, but really I'm a rhythm man.
Stephen Lee Cropper was born in 1941 in rural Missouri. His family moved to Memphis when he was nine, where he learned to play guitar and immersed himself in the burgeoning soul and R&B scenes. He formed his first band, the Royal Spades, with high school friends. They changed their name to the Marquees in 1961. That year, they came out with the instrumental track Last Night. It was a smash hit. By then, Cropper was already doing session work and soon found his way to Stax Records, which would become his musical home for nearly a decade. He went on to set up his own studio in 1970 and worked with many famous musicians, including Rod Stewart, John Prine, Ringo Starr, and John Lennon. Starting in 1978, Cropper joined John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd's blues and soul review act, the Blues Brothers. He even appeared in the Blues Brothers movies.
We're the good old Blues Brothers, boys, band from Chicago.
Cropper's collaboration with the comedians wasn't universally adored. Rock historian Ed Ward showed his disdain in an otherwise glowing tribute to the musician on Fresh Air in 1987.
Unfortunately, his most visible moments recently were with Aykroyd and Belushi's minstrel show, The Blues Brothers.
For his part, Steve Cropper told NPR in 2011 he always got a kick out of hearing the music he worked on over the years while driving.
And I turn the radio on and boom, there's either Knock on Wood or Green Onions or...
Right.
Or Dock of the Bay or Midnight Hour.
The musician said nothing beats that thrill, except perhaps being with his family. Chloe Veltman, NPR News. When there's
no one else around. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson, Ella McKay, in theaters December 12th. from Total Wine and More, where people can find wine, spirits, and beers for holiday gatherings at Total Wine and More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina, available to adults 21 or older. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on ARM, ARM.com, and from the listeners of KQED. And your KQED traffic update at 4:59 starts on the Dublin Grade. With the latest, here's Julie Deppish.
Yeah, bad one here at eastbound 580 before Foothill Road. That motorcycle crash is now blocking the two left lanes. Traffic stopped all the way back to Redwood Road. And getting word of a hit-and-run entry crash, Mill Valley on North 101 before Seminary Drive. Maybe over on the shoulder. And want to be careful in Redwood City on North 101 before Whipple, a pickup truck, spilled a load of trash across all the lanes. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Julie's next update is at 518. Support for traffic comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa at Yosemite. And support for KQED comes from Oakland Ballet, presenting Graham Lustig's The Nutcracker, December 20th and 21st, a beloved holiday tradition and magical holiday experience in Oakland's iconic Paramount Theater. Tickets at Oakland.